like a bullet. Please, no. Not Damascene, too. I didn't want to know any more. I stood up, staggered a few feet away, and collapsed. I pressed my face into the earth. I wanted to lie on the cold, cold ground and sleep with the rest of my family. I wanted to hear nothing, see nothing, feel nothing. I had so many tears to cry, and I sobbed into the dirt. Jean-Paul was at my side, trying to comfort me. He wiped the dirt from my face and gently rubbed my neck, but I pushed his hand away. Please, let me deal with this. I have to learn to be on my own now, Jean-Paul. No one in this world can comfort me now. Leave me alone for a while. He walked away to the other side of the camp. I lay on my back, looked at heaven, and cried. I cried until I had no more tears. I thought about what Jesus had promised me in my dream and began talking to him. You told me they would all be dead when I left the bathroom, and you were right, I said. They are all dead. Everything I loved in this world has been taken away. I'm putting my life in your hands, Jesus. Keep your promise and take care of me. I'll keep my promise. I will be your faithful daughter. I closed my eyes and pictured the faces of my family, and I prayed that God would keep them close and warm. Chapter 18, Camp Comfort. The French camp was an armed fort that kept Tutsis in and Hutus out. The soldiers parked 8 tank-like armored vehicles in a semicircle in front of the school buildings, and the outer perimeter of the camp was patrolled day and night by at least 100 guards. We stayed inside the semicircle of the armored vehicles with 30 soldiers who were assigned to protect us around the clock and to escort us into the forest whenever nature called. The French soldiers continually apologized for the deplorable conditions we were forced to live under, which made me laugh. Compared to where we'd come from, we were living a life of total comfort. For starters, we could fetch water from a stream and wash ourselves and our clothes with soap. We slept outside, which the French also thought was a major hardship, but I welcomed it. Even though I often woke up covered in dirt and twigs and aching from lying on rocks and stones, I loved falling asleep staring at the stars. It was like seeing the face of God at the end of the day. The soldiers fed us packaged cheese and crackers, tins of powdered milk, and canned fruit. It was a limited diet, but I slowly began filling out a bit. The French said that their job was to protect us, and they did it well. I never once felt threatened by the killers while I was at the camp. New groups of Tutsi survivors arrived every day, most of whom were confused and disoriented and spoke only Kinyarwanda. Because I was bilingual, the captain asked me to register all incoming refugees, and I was happy to help. I recorded their names and ages and reported their injuries and medical needs to the French soldiers. I also wrote down their personal stories and a history of what they'd been through. Through this process, I heard many horrific tales, but made some lasting friendships. One new pal was Florence, a young woman about my age with a sweet, innocent smile. She was very pretty, despite the deep scar running down her face from being chopped between the eyes with a machete. I jotted down her story, which, sadly, was as common as it was gruesome. Florence was from a small town not far from my village. When the genocide began, her family and 300 of her neighbors sought asylum at their local chapel, thinking that the killers would respect the sanctity of the church. But finding Tutsis jammed together in one room only made it easier for the killers, who simply walked between the pews swinging their blades.
"We had no weapons, no way to defend ourselves," Florence said, her big, kind eyes filling with tears. "There was some screaming and begging, but most of us just sat there waiting for our turn to be slaughtered. It was like we thought that we deserved to be murdered, that it was all perfectly natural. They reached me, and all I can remember is the machete coming down toward my face. Then I woke up in the truck. Florence's wound was deep, but not lethal. Yet the killers had tossed her into the back of a big truck with the rest of the corpses. When she woke up, she discovered that she was on top of her parents' bodies, and her sister was on top of her. My sister had a spear still stuck in her chest. She was almost dead, but still making gurgling noises. I tried to reach out to her, but one of the killers riding in the truck saw me move and started sticking me with his spear. He stuck me here, here, and here, she said, pointing to her chest, stomach, and thighs. I didn't flinch when he stabbed me. Instead, I asked God to take my pain and save my life. That killer must have thought I was dead because I was bleeding so much. The truck then stopped at the edge of a cliff high above the river, a favorite spot of the Interahamwe for dumping corpses. They threw all the bodies over the cliff and into the river, Florence continued. I remember them grabbing me by my feet and swinging me into the air, and I heard the sound of the water rushing in the distance, but I don't remember falling. I woke up in the mud by the riverbank the next morning. My parents and sister were lying there too, but they were all dead. I looked up at the cliff and couldn't imagine how I survived. It was at least a 200-foot drop. I can only believe that God spared me for something. Florence lay by the riverbank for a day before she could get up and walk away. She stumbled to the nearest house where some kind Hutus took her in, dressed her wounds, and hid her. Even though they saved my life, she continued, their son left the house every morning, met with the Interahamwe, and kept killing Tutsis in my town until there were none left to kill. Nothing makes sense to me anymore, Immaculate. Why do you think I lived and my parents and sister didn't? God has spared you for a reason, I answered. I'm writing down your story, and someday someone will read it and know what happened. You're like me. You've been left to tell. I desperately wanted to talk to my brother, Imable, and let him know that I was alive, but there was no mail service and the phones weren't working, and it's not as if I had a number for him or money to pay for the call. Imable was 3,000 miles away studying in Senegal, and I prayed that he'd stay there. If he'd come back to Rwanda, he was sure to be dead like the rest of my family. So the war would have to end before I'd be able to reach him. But when would the war be over? The French didn't share news with us, and we had no radio we could listen to. The only news we received came from new arrivals to our increasingly crowded camp. Toward the end of July, I did learn that the Tutsi rebels of the RPF had claimed victory in the north, but that fighting continued in the east and south. The French had control of western Rwanda, where we were, including the shore of Lake Kivu and the border of Zaire. It was good news for us, but the situation was still extremely dangerous. Hundreds of thousands of Hutu refugees were in our area, trying to reach Lake Kivu and escape to Zaire. Each day, new Tutsi survivors were dropped at our gates. In the 3 weeks since I'd arrived at the camp, our number had grown from a couple dozen to nearly 150, and I continued to record their stories and medical conditions. Many of the refugees were severely wounded, missing limbs or maimed from other types of torture. Often their wounds had become badly infected, and I knew that they wouldn't survive. And those who hadn't lost limbs had often lost their minds, driven mad by loss, grief,
and the horror locked in their memory. Among the most difficult things for me to deal with at the camp were the orphans. For example, I'll never forget the two brothers, ages 3 and 4, who came to us from Kigali. Their parents had hid them in the ceiling of their house when killers arrived at their door. The parents were murdered, and the boys were retrieved a few days later by kind-hearted Hutu neighbors who brought them south when they fled the capital to escape the fighting. They delivered the boys to some French soldiers, explaining that they were about to cross into Zaire, which was too perilous a journey for the children. Both boys were running high fevers when they arrived at our camp. They were the youngest children in the camp, with no parent or relative to mind them, so I temporarily adopted and cared for them. With the French captain's help, I set up a bed for them inside the schoolhouse and got medicine to bring their fever down. It broke my heart to listen to them talk. They'd seen their parents' corpses, but were too young to understand the permanence of death. The older boy tried to take care of his younger brother by reminding him to be polite to strangers. The 3-year-old kept pestering his big brother for French fries and soda, and the big brother would always reply with gentle patience.
"You have to remember that we're not at home. We can't get French fries or soda here. We have to wait for Mommy and Daddy to come get us. Then we can have treats again. We can't act spoiled, or more bad things will happen."
When his little brother cried, he cradled him, saying,
"Don't cry. Mommy and Daddy will be here soon, and then you can have all the French fries you want. We have to wait, but Mommy and Daddy will make everything okay."
I knew that those boys would never see their parents again, and that in all likelihood, all their relatives were dead. I feared that their future would be filled with sadness, abuse, and denied opportunities, the kind of lives where bitterness and hatred easily take root. I saw the circle of hatred and mistrust forming in those innocent eyes, and I knew that God was showing me another reason He'd spared me. I vowed that one day, when I was strong and capable enough, I would do everything I could to help the children orphaned by the genocide. I would try to bring hope and happiness to their lives and to steer them away from embracing the hatred that had robbed them of their parents and of a family's love. At the beginning of August, the captain told me the camp was so full that he was going to move the majority of the refugees. The new camp was indoors, in a high school in Kibuye Town, with running water, better food, and real beds. I made sure my boys were the first to go so that they could be more comfortable. I was planning to go myself and take care of everybody, but the captain begged me to remain behind and help run the camp. They still needed a translator, and there were new survivors coming in all the time. He told me I'd help save lives if I stayed. How could I refuse? I stayed on at the camp, and I never saw the little brothers again. But I didn't forget my promise to take care of other children orphaned by violence, which there was never any shortage of in Rwanda. About 30 refugees remained in the old camp, including 8 friends I'd made, such as Florence and Jean-Paul. Our small group had become quite close and felt like a little family. In fact, our bond was so tight that all 9 of us refused to be transferred from the camp unless we were allowed to leave as a group. We continued to receive Tutsi refugees, but the camp was now running like a transit station. I registered survivors, and within a day or two, they were transferred to the larger camp in town. Chapter 19, The Road to the Rebels. On a hot afternoon in late August, the French captain notified me that we were being evicted. Operation Turquoise was wrapping up, so the French were preparing to leave Rwanda.
"We're shutting down our camp today," he said. "You have 2 hours to get everyone ready to leave."
"Leave for where?" I asked. "There are 30 people here. Where should I tell them to go? We have no homes."
I was stunned by the sudden news. We're taking you all to stay with Tutsi soldiers. The RPF has moved into the area and set up camp a few miles down the road. We'll take you there and hand you over to them. It will be better for you, since you'll be with your own people. I was thrilled to hear that the Tutsi soldiers had finally fought their way to us and were chasing the Interahamwe right out of the country. I even heard that our hero, RPF leader Paul Kagame, had set up a new government in Kigali. Thank God, we were finally safe. The genocide must really be over. It didn't take long to get ready, since we'd been prepared for a long time. No one owned anything, so we had no luggage to pack. I gathered up my meager belongings, the sweater and towel that Pastor Morinzi's daughter had given me, two books and some extra soap and T-shirts from the soldiers, and put them into a plastic bag. But as I did, I thought of my mother, packing her things in suitcases while the killers gathered near our home. And I decided that I didn't want to drag things from my past into my new life. I wanted to make a clean break. I took the bag and left it in a corner, hoping that some other poor, homeless Tutsi would find it. I was the last one to climb into the back of the truck. The tailgate slammed shut, the canvas top was rolled down to conceal us, and the truck rolled forward. I took out the rosary my father had given me, the one possession I would never surrender, and said a prayer. I asked God for his blessing on our new beginning and to shepherd us safely to the Tutsi soldiers. The truck pulled past the semicircle of armored vehicles, down a service road, and into a sea of killers. Through a crack in the top, I saw that thousands of Hutus were trudging along the main road toward Lake Kivu, and hundreds of them wore the uniform of the Interahamwe and carried machetes. "Oh, God," I said, falling back in the truck. "Not again." We inched along the crowded road, honking at Hutus to give way and let us by. I knew that if we were stopped, or if the truck broke down, the Interahamwe would fall upon us within minutes. I hadn't felt this frightened since I left the bathroom. "Please, God," I prayed. "You've brought us this far. Now take us the rest of the way. Blind these killers. Don't let them look in the back of this truck. Merciful God, shield us from their hateful eyes." We were more than halfway to the RPF camp when the truck stopped. The French captain came around to the back, pulled the top open, and said, "We have reports of gunfire in the area, and we have orders to avoid fighting at any cost. We're turning around, so this is where you'll have to get out." I thought I'd misheard him. "You mean that you're taking us back with you, right?" "No, we're breaking camp. You have to get out here now. I'm sorry, Immaculée." I'd gotten to know the captain well over the past few weeks. He hated the Hutu killers and said that he wanted to help Tutsis in any way he could, so I couldn't believe that he'd leave us in a group of armed Interahamwe. I climbed out of the truck to reason with him. "Please, Captain, you know better than anyone what will happen if you leave us here. There are killers all around us. Please, I'm begging you. Take us another mile to the RPF camp, or take us back with you. Don't leave us here to be killed."
"I'm sorry, Immaculée. I have my orders."
"Please, Captain, just take us."
"No. Now get your people out of the back. We have to leave."
We couldn't believe what was happening. A dozen or so Interahamwe was standing about 10 feet away, watching us and listening to our conversation with growing interest. I felt dizzy. The road was spinning, and all I could see for a moment was a blur of angry faces. I steadied myself on the side of the truck and for the first time noticed all the bodies on the ground. Corpses everywhere along the road, as far as I could see. I looked up at the captain, pleading with my eyes one last time. It was useless. He was immovable. Maybe they really were here to help the killers, because they were certainly about to leave us for dead. "Get out of the truck," I said to my friends. "Everybody out, the French are leaving us here." The cries of disbelief and fear coming from the back of the truck drew even more attention from the killers, who were now moving toward us. I looked one into the Humway straight in the eye and held his gaze. My heart told me that he was a person just like me, and that he really didn't want to kill. I held my rosary and summoned all my will to send a message of love to him. I prayed that God would use me to touch the killer with the power of his love. I didn't blink, and we stared into each other's eyes for what seemed like a lifetime. Finally, the killer broke my gaze and looked away. He turned his back to me and dropped his machete, as if the devil had left his body. But there were plenty of other devils to take his place. At least 15 Interahamwe were now standing a few yards from the truck, with machetes in their hands and smirks on their faces. They were figuring out what was happening, waiting to see if any of my companions would dare leave the truck. We had no choice but to come out. One by one, my friends hopped out, until all 30 of us were standing there facing the killers. When everyone was out, the French soldiers climbed into the cab and the truck pulled away at high speed, leaving us in a cloud of dust and uncertainty.
"Look at all these Tutsis," one of the killers said in amazement.
"How can it be that they're still alive?"
"These are the cockroaches that the French soldiers were protecting," another said. "Who's going to save you now, cockroaches?"
My friends were so scared that they could barely move. They nudged me, asking me what we should do, as though I was somehow an expert in dealing with ruthless killers. I looked at the machete scar on Florence's face, remembering the story she told me about sitting in a church with her family, waiting their turn for the killers to chop them to death. Well, I wasn't going to stand around and wait to die.
"Let's go," I said. "We'll walk to the RPF camp. Their soldiers are close by."
The killers heard me mention the RPF and got nervous. We began moving in the direction that the French had been taking us before they abandoned us. As we walked, I prayed my rosary, talking to God with all my heart and soul. "God, I really am walking through the valley of death. Please stay with me. Shield me with the power of your love. You created this ground that we're walking on, so please don't let these killers spill your daughter's blood on it." 3 Interahamwe followed us as we broke away from the larger group, and one of them recognized me.
"I know this cockroach," he said. "This is Leonard's daughter. We've been looking for her for months. I can't believe she's still alive. We killed the rest of them, but this little cockroach gave us the slip."
I prayed, walking as fast as I could and holding my father's rosary tightly in my hand.
"Dear God, only you can save me. You promised to take care of me, God. Well, I really need taken care of right now. There are devils and vultures at my back, Lord. Please protect me. Take the evil from the hearts of these men and blind their hatred with your holy love."
I walked without looking at my feet, not knowing if I was about to stumble over rocks or bodies, putting all my trust in God to guide me to safety. We were moving very briskly, but the killers were all around us now, circling us, slicing the air with their machetes. We were defenseless, so why were they waiting to strike? "If they kill me, God, I ask you to forgive them. Their hearts have been corrupted by hatred, and they don't know why they want to hurt me." After walking a half mile like that, I heard Jean-Paul say,
"Hey, they're gone! They're gone!"
I looked around, and it was true. The killers had left us. Jean-Paul said later that it was probably because they knew the RPF soldiers were close by. But I knew the real reason, and I never stopped thanking God for saving us on that road. A few minutes later, we saw an RPF roadblock and several dozen tall, lean, stone-faced Tutsi soldiers standing guard. I broke into an all-out run and dropped to my knees in front of them. I closed my eyes and sang their praises. Thank God we're saved. Thank God you're here. Bless you. Bless you all. If only you knew what we've been through. Thank you for... I didn't get a chance to finish my sentence because I was cut off by the chilling metallic sound of a machine gun bolt being pulled back. I opened my eyes, only to see that the barrel of a gun was an inch from my face. Chapter 20. On to Kigali.
Oh, God. When will you put an end to this nightmare?
I looked over the gun barrel and into the cold, angry eyes of a Tutsi soldier. They reminded me of the killer's eyes I'd stared down not 20 minutes before. If these were the same RPF soldiers we'd been hoping would rescue us since the genocide began, then maybe it really was my time to die. My neighbors had turned on me. The killers were hunting me. The French had abandoned me. And now my Tutsi saviors were preparing to blow my brains out. I prayed silently. It's up to you, God. Live or die, it doesn't matter to me as long as I'm serving your will. You have brought me here. It's up to you to decide. I tried to get to my feet, slowly raising my hands in the air while explaining that my friends and I were Tutsis. The French soldiers left us in the road.
Shut your mouth and sit on the ground, the soldier shouted, poking me with his rifle. If you're Tutsis, why are you still alive?
A different one screamed, pointing his gun at me.
Everyone is dead. Everyone. You're killers yourselves. You're Hutu spies.
Do you know what we do to spies? Sit still. Don't say a word and don't move a muscle. Angry soldiers surrounded us, so there was no point in talking. I kept my mouth shut and waited for whatever destiny had in store for me. Minutes passed. Eventually, the rebel commander arrived to question us. The soldiers guarding us saluted him and called him Major. He was tall, skinny as a stick, and one of the calmest-looking people I'd ever seen. He looked at us like we were thieves who'd been caught breaking into his house. It was obvious that the Major didn't believe that we were genocide survivors, so I began praying. But of course, that's when God stepped in once again.
Immaculée? Immaculée, il est Beguisa?
A soldier standing beside the Major was saying my name and staring at me in disbelief.
Immaculée, it can't be you, can it? Is it really you?
Basil?
It is you.
He dropped his rifle, knelt to the ground, and gave me a big hug. Basil was a Hutu neighbor who'd gone to fight with the Tutsi rebels. We'd known each other since school, and he'd been my mother's favorite student for many years because he was so bright and gifted. Mom liked him so much that she invited him to the house many times.
You know this girl?
The Major asked when Basil finished embracing me.
Oh, yes. We went to school together. Her parents are very respected Tutsis in my village. They're very good people. She's all right, Major. She's not a spy. Whatever Immaculée says is true.
I quickly thanked God for sending Basil at the very moment I needed him. The soldiers lowered their guns, and the Major reached out and shook my hand. I'm Major Ntwali, he said. I'm sorry about the confusion, but there are spies everywhere. It's still very dangerous around here, but you're safe with us. The war is over for you. We'll protect you from now on.
Thank you, and God bless you.
Bazil sat down next to me and anxiously peppered me with questions.
I haven't been home in months. Do you have news from the village? How is teacher? I mean, your mom. Any news about my parents or my brothers and sisters? The last time I saw them, they were going to leave the country. Did they get out?
I put my hand on Bazil's arm. I knew the pain I was about to cause him, so I tried to be as gentle as possible.
I don't know how to tell you this, Bazil, other than to tell you the truth. Everyone is dead. My family, your family, almost every Tutsi and moderate Hutu in our village. They're all dead.
He looked at me as if he'd forgotten how to speak, and then he crumpled into a ball at my feet, his chest heaving in spasms as he sobbed onto the butt of his rifle. Poor Bazil, he'd lost his parents, 4 brothers, and 3 sisters. I understood now why we'd been treated with such suspicion when we arrived. Many of these soldiers had been fighting their way down from Uganda and had no news from home along the way. They were now returning to find their families slaughtered by neighbors, people they trusted all their lives.
I'm sorry, the major said. Do you blame us?
What do you mean? I asked, confused by the question.
A lot of my soldiers blame themselves for what happened. They think that we spent too much time fighting to take over Kigali while hundreds of thousands of Tutsis were being killed, including their own families. They think we took too long to get here.
They shouldn't think like that, Major. It's not your fault. You fought to save us. You fought the devil. Now we have to make sure we never face the same battle. We have to stop killing and learn to forgive.
He shook his head at me in disapproval. Don't talk to me about God or the devil. I know who did this.
You can forgive all you want to, Immaculée. But maybe you haven't looked into as many mass graves as I have. The people who filled those graves are still out there. And believe me, they don't deserve your forgiveness. They deserve to be shot, and I intend to give them what they deserve. I'll forgive them when they're dead.
The major pointed to a nearby Baptist church. You'll find other survivors in there. Stay put until we figure out what to do with you, and don't wander off. Remember, you're still in a war zone. If you run into some Interahamwe, they won't be as forgiving as you are. My little group and I stayed in the church with about 100 other Tutsi survivors. There were no beds or blankets, but we were happy to have a roof over our heads, and it felt good to be in a house of God. Bazil had food to give us, which I volunteered to cook. But as I tried to light a cooking fire outside, I felt nauseated by a sickening stench.
What in the Lord's name is that smell?
I asked one of the soldiers posted to stand guard over us. He took me by the hand and, without saying a word, led me behind the church. It was an image from hell. Row upon row of corpses, hundreds and hundreds of them stacked up like firewood. A black carpet of flies hovered about them, and crows picked at the top layer of the dead. An old man stood at the edge of the pile, shooing away dogs with a stick. I covered my mouth, my eyes wide in horror. Then the soldier pointed beyond the piles to a deep pit, at least 30 yards across and 20 feet deep. It was filled with bodies, maybe tens of thousands of them. I turned my head, vomited, and staggered back to the front of the church. The soldier followed me, still saying nothing.
Are you from this area?
I asked. He nodded, and I understood then that somewhere in that rotting pit of humanity was his family. His pain was beyond words. How many years, how many generations would it take before Rwanda could recover from such horror? How long for our wounded hearts to heal, for our hardened hearts to soften? too long for me, I decided. Looking into that soldier's eyes, I realized that I was going to have to leave Rwanda. I'd have to leave the sorrow and suffering of this country behind, at least for a while. In order to help heal others, as I knew God wanted me to, I needed the perspective that only space and time could provide. I had to first heal myself to be able to assist others. By early October, all my friends from the French camp had left, and everything around me was starting to change. 1 million Tutsi refugees from the 1959 and 1973 genocides were returning to Rwanda from around the world. The same number of Tutsis murdered in the genocide, a number beyond my comprehension. As the Tutsis returned, more than 2 million Hutus fled Rwanda to escape vengeance killings. Most of them ended up living in squalid refugee camps in other countries, while many died of disease and malnutrition. Both tribes were victims of the genocide, and so was Rwanda herself. One day, when I'd learned more and saved enough money, I would leave the sadness of my country far behind me. But for now, I had small changes to make. Chapter 21, Forgiving the Living. I knew that my family was at peace, but that didn't ease the pain of missing them. And I couldn't shake the crippling sorrow that seized my heart whenever I envisioned how they'd been killed. Every night I prayed to be released from my private agony, from the nightmares that haunted my sleep and troubled my days. It took a while, but as always, God answered my prayers. This time, He did so by sending me a dream unlike any I've ever had. I was in a helicopter flying over my family's house, but I was trapped in a dark cloud. I could see Mom, Dad, Damascene, and Vianney high above me, standing in the sky and bathed in a warm white light that radiated tranquility. The light intensified and spread across the sky until it engulfed the dark cloud hiding me. And suddenly, I was with my family again. The dream was so real that I reached out and felt the warmth of their skin, the gentleness of their touch. I was so happy that I danced in the air. "Hey, Immaculée, it's good to see that we can still make you happy. You've been gloomy far too long and must stop all this crying. Look at the wonderful place we're in. Can you see how happy we are? If you continue to believe that we're suffering, you'll force us to return to the pain we've left behind. I know how much you miss us, but do you really want us to come back and suffer?" "No. No, Damascene," I cried out, as tears of joy poured from my eyes. "Don't come back here. Wait for me there, and I will come join you all. When God is done with me in this life, I will come to you. We'll be here waiting, dear sister. Now heal your heart. You must love, and you must forgive those who have trespassed against us." My family slowly receded into the sky until they disappeared into the heavens. I was still hovering over my house, but I was no longer in a dark cloud and no longer in a helicopter. I was flying like a bird above my village, above the pastor's house and the French camp, above all the forests and rivers and waterfalls of my beautiful country. I was soaring above Rwanda. I felt so liberated from grief and gravity that I began to sing for joy. I sang from my heart words which in Kinyarwanda mean, "Thank you, God, for love that is beyond our understanding." From that night onward, my tears began to dry and my pain eased. I never again agonized over the fate of my family. I accepted that I would always mourn and miss them, but I'd never spend another moment worrying about the misery they'd endured. By sending me that dream, God had shown me that my family was in a place beyond suffering. He'd also shown me that I had to make another trip to my village. I went to my old house, and I wept. But this time, my tears were a release, not a sorrow. The landscape of my youth no longer saddened me. Rather, I was heartened by the warm memories stirred by the sights and sounds around me. It was time to do what I'd come to do. I arrived at the prison late in the afternoon and was greeted by Semana, the new burgomaster of Kibuye. Semana had been a teacher before the genocide, as well as a colleague and good friend of my dad's. He was like an uncle to me. Four of his six children had been killed in the slaughter, and I told him he must have faith that his little ones were with God. As burgomaster, Semana was a powerful politician in charge of arresting and detaining the killers who had terrorized our area. He'd interrogated hundreds of Interahamwe and knew better than anyone which killers had murdered whom. And he knew why I'd come to see him. "Do you want to meet the leader of the gang that killed your mother and Damascene?" "Yes, sir, I do." I watched through Samana's office window as he crossed the courtyard to the prison cell and then returned, shoving a disheveled, limping old man in front of him. I jumped up with a start as they approached, recognizing the man instantly. His name was Felician, and he was a successful Hutu businessman whose children I'd played with in primary school. I shivered, remembering that it had been his voice I'd heard calling out my name when the killers searched for me at the pastor's. Felician had hunted me. Semana pushed Felician into the office, and he stumbled onto his knees. When he looked up from the floor and saw that I was the one who was waiting for him, the color drained from his face. He quickly shifted his gaze and stared at the floor.
"Stand up, killer!" Semana shouted. "Stand up and explain to this girl why her family is dead. Explain to her why you murdered her mother and butchered her brother. Get up, I said. Get up and tell her."
Semana screamed even louder, but the battered man remained hunched and kneeling, too embarrassed to stand and face me. His dirty clothing hung from his emaciated frame in tatters. His skin was sallow, bruised, and broken, and his eyes were filmed and crusted. His once handsome face was hidden beneath a filthy, matted beard, and his bare feet were covered in open, running sores. I wept at the sight of his suffering. He had let the devil enter his heart, and the evil had ruined his life like a cancer in his soul. He was now the victim of his victims, destined to live in torment and regret. I was overwhelmed with pity for the man.
"He looted your parents' home and robbed your family's plantation, Immaculée. We found your dad's farm machinery at his house, didn't we?"
Semana yelled at Felician.
"After he killed Rose and Damascene, he kept looking for you. He wanted you dead so he could take over your property. Didn't you, pig?"
Semana shouted again. I flinched, letting out an involuntary gasp. Semana looked at me, stunned by my reaction and confused by the tears streaming down my face. He grabbed Felician by the shirt collar and hauled him to his feet.
"What do you have to say to her? What do you have to say to Immaculée?"
Felician was sobbing. I could feel his shame. He looked up at me for only a moment, but our eyes met. I reached out, touched his hands lightly, and quietly said what I'd come to say. "I forgive you." My heart eased immediately, and I saw the tension release in Felician's shoulders before Semana pushed him out the door and into the courtyard. Two soldiers yanked Felician up by his armpits and dragged him back toward his cell. When Semana returned, he was furious.
"What was that all about, Immaculée? That was the man who murdered your family. I brought him to you to question, to spit on if you wanted to. But you forgave him. How could you do that? Why did you forgive him?"
I answered him with the truth. Forgiveness is all I have to offer. Epilogue. New love, new life. It's impossible to predict how long it will take a broken heart to heal. I was blessed, though. With God's help, my heart was strong enough to love another after 2 years. But while I healed, I lived a quiet, reflective life. In late 1995, I was finally reunited with Aimable. We'd written often and talked on the phone a few times during the year, but we weren't prepared for actually seeing each other face to face. We found it difficult to look each other in the eye, knowing that if our true feelings surfaced, we'd be unable to control them, that if we began crying, we'd never be able to stop. After a while, it was clear that we'd silently agreed not to talk about what had happened to our family. We mentioned everyone by name, but spoke about them as if they were still alive. It was the only way we could cope. Still, after more than a decade, we never talk about our family in the past tense. I suppose it's our way of keeping their memory alive. As my heart slowly recovered, I began to dream of sharing my life with someone special, of having a family of my own to care for and love. So, as I learned to do whenever faced with a problem or challenge, I called on God. If I wanted a marriage made in heaven, what better matchmaker could there be? The Bible tells us that if we ask, we shall receive, and that's exactly what I did. I asked God to bring me the man of my dreams. I began to visualize it, believing in my heart that it had already come to pass. I'd put it all in God's hands and knew that it was only a matter of time before he would bless me with my wish. But to hurry things along, I took out my father's red and white rosary and began praying for my husband to show up. 3 months later, he did. Mr. Brian Black, who was sent by God, courtesy of the UN, all the way from America. 2 years later, Brian and I were married in a traditional Rwandan ceremony, and we came to America a short while later, in 1998. We have a loving, supportive marriage, and God has blessed us with 2 beautiful children. God remains a part of my life every day and in every way. He sustains me, protects me, and fulfills me. He makes me a better wife, a better mother, and a better person. And he's helped me make a career for myself as well. I prayed for God to guide me, and then I looked for the position I wanted at the United Nations. Once I knew where I wanted to work, I visualized that I already had a job there, using the same technique of positive thinking I'd always used, believe and receive. I went to the UN website, printed out the directory that listed the employees' names and titles, and then added my name to the list. I even gave myself a telephone extension. I tacked the directory onto my wall and looked at it every day. Of course, I also filled out an application, submitted a resume, and made follow-up phone calls, but so had more than 1,000 other people. I kept looking at my directory, believing that the job was mine, and I prayed every day until my phone rang. Sure enough, I was shortlisted out of hundreds of other applicants and was offered the job after I went in for an interview. I've never ceased to be amazed by seeing God's power at work. This is the same power that I feel propelling me forward into the next phase of my life. God saved my soul and spared my life for a reason. He left me to tell my story to others and show as many people as possible the healing power of his love and forgiveness. There are people I left behind that I must help. I hope to return to Rwanda as often as I can, to aid in restoring hope to the hearts of genocide survivors, especially the orphan children. I am currently setting up a foundation that will help victims of genocide and war everywhere to heal in body, mind, and spirit. God's message extends beyond borders. Anyone in the world can learn to forgive those who have injured them, however great or small that injury may be. I know that Rwanda can heal herself if each heart learns the lesson of forgiveness. Tens of thousands who were jailed for killing during the genocide are starting to be released into their old towns and villages, so if there was ever a time for forgiveness, it is now. Rwanda can be a paradise again, but it will take the love of the entire world to heal my homeland. And that's as it should be, for what happened in Rwanda happened to us all. Humanity was wounded by the genocide. The love of a single heart can make a world of difference. I believe that we can heal Rwanda and our world by healing one heart at a time. I hope my story helps.
This has been a Hay House audiobook production.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.